From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. What if I told you one of the most successful animated shows on TV is about a family of squids?
Listen here. Ratings don't never not done nothing for not nobody.
I think you mean not nobody.
Excuse me, not nobody. Never not no one.
That's from Squidbillies, the 11th season finale, airs this weekend. We'll talk with the co-creators about their experiences in Georgia that shaped that series. First, though, we recently talked about how state lawmakers plan to withhold funding from universities with so-called sanctuary campus policies that protect undocumented students.
I believe it is a moral issue that, young people who've done nothing wrong, these kids have done nothing wrong. You know, if an adult is caught speeding and their child is in the car, the child is not a criminal.
That's Elizabeth Keish, president of Agnes Scott College in Decatur. Here are your first thoughts. This voicemail comes from a listener in South Atlanta who did not leave his name.
I'm a poor person. I think the wall is necessary. The people are competing for jobs at fast food places and cleaning offices, and that's not good. We need to get our own people jobs first before we have immigration.
It's always good to get your thoughts. You can call us, like that person did, at 404-500-9457. Find us on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The Trump administration's immigration crackdown has led to a nationwide uptick in arrests. New federal data shows arrests in Georgia and the Carolinas are up from last fiscal year. And the president's attitude toward immigrants from Mexico is well known.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
Some characterize Trump's comments as not just anti-Mexican, but anti-immigrant. My next guest says that kind of animus is older than America itself. Historian Kenneth C. Davis is the author of the Don't Know Much About series, among many other books, and he joins us from New York. Good to have you back, Ken.
Good morning, Celeste. Always a pleasure to be with you.
So what kind of character, what category is included for anti-immigrant? How do you sort of delineate that? Anyone who wasn't born here?
Well, that's what we call immigrants in general, so I suppose so. Of course, we have this whole class of dreamers. It's a different class of immigrants in this country right now, children who were brought here illegally but raised essentially for their entire lives as Americans. So that's one complicating factor. But I think to speak to the first question, the issue of how this country has viewed immigrants is really an important one, because we do have this myth, this, you put it on the front cover of the kids' textbooks and school books, the melting pot myth, the rainbow, the wonderful place of opportunity. But the history really shows that that life has been anything but a melting pot for most immigrants, going back to, as you said, the time before the country was even a nation.
So how far back could it possibly go? I mean, at some point, the people who are coming here from mostly Europe, did they think of themselves as immigrants?
Well, of course, every different group that gets here thinks of themselves as somehow entitled, I suppose. When we think about kind of America in the sense of the United States of America, the beginning of that period of our history, if you go back, for instance, to the 1750s, well before independence, you had people in Pennsylvania who were concerned about a rush of immigrants who didn't speak the language, who were seemed to be of a criminal class, who weren't teaching their children the language, that the signposts were in a different language, and this was seen as a threat to democracy in America itself, or I should say to the government itself. The man who expressed those opinions was Benjamin Franklin in the 1750s, and the people he was speaking about were Germans. There were even German Americans who expressed the same concern about the new wave of Germans coming in. So again, this goes back to a time before there was a United States of America. Shortly after the Revolution, when the Constitution is written, drafted, and ratified, the next crisis came over France, being in the throes of a revolution. So the French became the dangerous group that should be kept out, and we passed legislation to keep them out, called the Alien Acts, part of the Alien and Sedition Acts. This actually authorized the president, John Adams at the time, to deport anyone without any due process, of course. Adams never did so. And as time went by, the names and the of origin of countries changed, but the attitudes did not.
Well,
people who
hear...
were here, and I would single out especially because it was the longest lasting and most significant, Irish Catholics. And that's where the point of religion comes into this as well, because religion and fear of immigrants go hand in hand from the beginning.
So let's actually hear, this is actually from the film Gangs of New York. And in this clip, you're going to hear two characters talking as they watch Irish immigrants arrive at the loading docks in 19th century New York City.
Americans are boring.
I don't see no Americans. I see trespassers. Irish hops do a job for a nickel with a does for a dime, and a white man used to get a quarter for.
What have they done? Name one thing they've contributed.
Votes.
Votes, you say? They vote how the Archbishop tells them, and who tells the Archbishop? Their king in the pointy hat, what sits on his throne in Rome.
Bill's got mixed feelings as regards the Irish.
So we're speaking with historian Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About series. You point out that with the Irish, we started to get this hatred against religion in particular. What did that, how did that change the view of immigrants?
Well, I think it was the anti-Catholic mood in this country was always a powerful part of American history that we tend to brush under the carpet because it's embarrassing. It doesn't fit in with our notion of a nation that welcomes all believers, and it certainly doesn't fit in with the notion of a Christian nation. What it was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation. And the Irish were disdained, hated, feared because of all the reasons that we hate and fear other immigrants, as the caller earlier said. They take the jobs. They're willing to work for less. They're dirty. They're diseased. They're ignorant. They don't speak the language. With the Irish, the element of anti-Catholicism became part of the mix, and very powerfully. This was not just a small argument over how to say prayers. This was a deep-seated hatred that had caused wars in Europe for centuries. The Founding Fathers understood that, and that is one of the reasons that people like Washington and Jefferson and Madison were so, and Adams, were so concerned that this be a secular nation. They knew the danger of religion getting into the politics. But in the early 19th century, it was widely felt that Catholics were not only dangerous and Irish Catholics dangerous because they took jobs, but there was a belief that they were actually trying to overthrow the government and that they would install the Pope in a new Vatican that was to be built in all places in Cincinnati. This was preached, an idea that was preached from some of the most prominent pulpits in America, including that of Harriet Beecher Stowe's father and others. This was
author
the
of
mainstream.
Uncle Tom's Cabin, yeah.
Yes, this was the mainstream of America in early 19th century America. And of course, it continued for much of the next century. When John F. Kennedy is elected in 1960, it is an astonishing moment that America gets a Roman Catholic president because of the great and deep antipathy, especially from evangelical Christians, towards Catholic. Billy Graham and Norman Vincent Peale, the two most prominent preachers of that day, both campaigned vigorously, although somewhat secretly, to keep John F. Kennedy out of the White House, not because of his political beliefs, but because of his religion.
Let's actually hear, this is actually former Republican Congressman Brian Bilbray in 2010. He's on the show Hardball on MSNBC, and he's describing how people might be able to identify undocumented immigrants.
They will look at the kind of dress you wear. There is different type of attire. There's different type of, you went right down to the shoes, right down to the clothes, but mostly by behavior. It's mostly behavior, just as the law enforcement people here in Washington, D.C. does it based on certain criminal activity. There is behavior things that professionals are trained in across the board, and this group shouldn't be exempt from those observations as much as anybody else.
How common is it, Ken, to sort of excuse anti-immigrant behavior in the United States by couching it in terms of safety?
It's always been part of the idea of keeping immigrants out. And of course, every generation that arrives gets here, gets settled in, and then wants to pull up the ladder to keep the next generation from coming in. It's exactly what people feared about the Germans in the 1750s, the French in the 1790s, the Irish for nearly 200 years, and later on go down the list, the Chinese who built the railroads were then actually excluded as a race from this country under what were offensively called the Coolie Laws. Later on, of course, after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese Americans, some born here, were interned in what we have to call concentration camps. So this is part of our political, historical DNA. We fear these things. We think about the Ku Klux Klan primarily as a racist, racial organization, but it was as deeply anti-foreign, especially in the 1920s, as it was anti-black. This was after the First World War, when there was an influx of refugees. Yes, refugees have come to America for a very long time, and immigrants from Eastern Europe, some of the Southern European countries. The Italians were specifically limited. There were immigration, very, very sharp restrictions on immigration in the 1920s that targeted Italians and people from Eastern Europe. Once again, Italians had the layer of criminality because of those stereotypes, as well as being Catholic. So they had the double whammy of, again, criminal and Catholic.
We only have about less than a minute left, Kenneth, but do you see anything new in the current wave of anti-immigrant sentiment, or is it all pretty much historically echoed?
Well, I think this echoes the same arguments that we've heard for centuries in this country, and that's why I say it is part of our political DNA. Of course, the stakes have gone up in our time. I'm speaking to you from New York, a city where Times Square is on lockdown at the moment. I don't know the reasons, but there clearly, we are living in dangerous times. A few weeks ago, I was getting ready to ride my bicycle up the West Side Highway on that day. So these are different times for this country, but I don't believe that should allow us to dismiss the very, very fundamental ideas that the country was founded on, and those founding fathers believed in a great deal. There's a reason that John Adams never exercised the power he had as president to deport anyone. He did not personally believe in that idea.
Yeah.
I think that's important to remember.
Yeah.
When we let fear overwhelm reason, rationality, and good information, we go down a very troubling path.
Historian Kenneth C. Davis, he's author of the Don't Know Much About series. Ken, thank you so much.
It is always a pleasure, Celeste. Thanks so much for having me.
Just ahead, do you understand Bitcoin? First, though, we'll take a look at some groundbreaking medical transplant procedures. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. For the first time in history, doctors will attempt to perform a head transplant. It'll be performed by two physicians in China, originally planned for this month, but for a number of reasons, it has been pushed back to 2018. The procedure, not surprisingly, spawns a number of ethical concerns. It includes what happens to one's identity when one is given a new body. Emory University's neuroethics program is leading the international conversation about the surgery. Paul Wolpe is the director of the Center for Ethics at Emory, and he joins me in studio. Hello again.
Hello.
And via Skype, we have Jordan Amadio, chief resident in neurosurgery at Emory. Hi, Jordan.
Hello, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. And Paul, we don't at this point know if a head transplant is possible. And I wonder if the ethics conversation has to hinge on that. Do you have to wait to truly discuss ethics until a procedure is possible?
Well, part of the ethical question is what we mean by possible. And that is, there should be adequate animal experimentation ahead of time. Doctors Canavero and Wren have not done the proper animal experimentation, or at least have not published that they've done that proper experimentation. So part of the ethical conversation does revolve around what are the adequate precautions and expertise one should have before one tries it.
I want to actually play this comment from one of the doctors who operated on the 8-year-old Zion Harvey. Zion had the first bilateral hand transplant. And here's one of the doctors explaining how complicated that is.
In the beginning of the operation, we actually had four teams operating at the same time, and each of them had specific things they were supposed to do. So they had to find all the structures, put pre-made tags on for every single structure that we'd have to repair, and they would have to sew those onto the nerves, blood vessels, tendons, etc.
So Jordan, that's just talking about hands. That's without even bringing the spinal cord into all this. Do you believe a head transplant is a possibility?
Well, one thing that people need to understand about this topic, Celeste, is that this is very far outside the mainstream of neurosurgery. I'm a practicing neurosurgeon. I deal with patients who have spinal cord injuries all the time, people with head trauma, other diseases of the brain and spine. And although, you know, what we do in our field has progressed rapidly over the past century in terms of what's possible, you might get the sense from looking at the news stories around Dr. Canavero's work that this is, you know, imminent. And this is something considered to be very feasible by a majority of people in our field. That's not the case. This is so far outside the mainstream that really it's a question of whether you'd like to take these claims seriously or not. If you do take the claims seriously, which, you know, perhaps is a question for Dr. Wolpe, but if we take them on their face, if we take them seriously, then we can look objectively at some of the obstacles to actually doing this successfully.
Okay, so We don't know if it's possible. It's quite possible. It's not possible. So, Paul, why lead from the Center for Ethics? Why have a conversation about the ethics of a procedure which may not be realistic?
Because there was a lot of press about doing this, and the conversation had already started in the public and among speculative journalists. So we thought it might be prudent to bring in experts on this and try to correct some of the misapprehensions that had been in the press, first of all around the feasibility of it, but also for people to think seriously about if it were feasible, what might be some of the ethical challenges, because they're interesting in and of themselves. If you took Jordan's head and put it on my body, who is that person? And why is it that we think it's Jordan and not Paul? Because we have a very, what I call, cerebrocentric view of the world, where the brain is everything that we are. And yet we've learned over time, recently especially, how important we are as embodied beings, as organisms with a full body that contribute profoundly to who we are as individuals. So we wanted to have that conversation as well as the sort of pure, would it be ethical to do it conversation.
So Jordan, let's weigh in on this then. Set aside the whole question of feasibility and talk about where the personality lies. This is your area of expertise. You're a neurosurgeon. When we're talking about personality, when we're talking about, so quote unquote, a soul, is it within the body or the brain?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, first of all, the composite creature that we're posing between Paul and myself, I would not want to meet that thing in a dark alley. That's terrifying. I think when it comes to questions of the soul and things such as this, those are questions that go beyond the scope of biomedicine. I mean, they're philosophical questions. I think that everything we know and the assumptions we make when we take care of patients who have severe problems with the brain and spine that necessitate thinking about things like, where's the personality? Is this person going to be the same after the brain is injured? We assume that the brain is the locus of one's personality and one's human identity. That's why this, you know, quite rightly, if we are to take these claims of, quote, head transplantation seriously, it would be better called a body transplant, not a head transplant. And I think that's been repeated several times in the commentary about this in the literature that you see. I think what really concerns me, as Paul was alluding to, is that the way Dr. Canavero, who's this Italian neurosurgeon who's proposing this procedure, and his Chinese collaborators, the way they've conducted themselves is not in alignment with the standards of the scientific or the neurosurgical community. When you look at the history of transplantation in the early days, in the 1950s, when Joe Murray and his colleagues performed the first kidney transplant in 1954, there was two decades or more of published research on animal data on sort of small-scale human trials leading up to the transplant that really showed, okay, this is something that may be safe and effective to attempt. Then you had the big, you know, the big medical event that made the news. But we don't have that track record of successful published animal experiments and or human experiments going into this. And that's what makes me skeptical. And that's what I think, you know, for the general public to be talking about this now is really a risk, because it risks harming the ability of neuroscientists and neurosurgeons to get the public to support the research when, you know, this may be exposed as being fraudulent or perhaps not what we thought.
Well, let's hear from Valery Spiridonov. He's one of the first people to volunteer for this head transplant. Valery eventually backed off that volunteer last year, but he's severely disabled, and he spoke here to Good Morning Britain about why he might want to do it.
Today my life is pretty tough. I need to invite people to help me every day, even twice a day, because I need someone to take me off my bed, and so it makes my life pretty dependable from other people. And if there will be a way to change this, I believe that it should be tried, used.
And here's, Paul, where the Center for Ethics makes it so important, right? Because this is always a question about helping a patient, is it not?
Yes, and one of the standards of medical ethics and of medicine in general is we don't do treatments until they're ready. Every treatment is designed to help someone in need. And so there are always people with diseases or conditions or syndromes sitting out there waiting for medical procedures to be perfected. And there's always the compelling argument, let's do it now while these people are suffering. But we've created standards so that these treatments don't end up causing more harm than good. And I think those standards are what make Western medicine so successful as an enterprise. And if we start abandoning those standards in order to rush to these kinds of surgeries in order to try to help people, even with the best of motives, we begin to erode exactly that level of excellence that makes Western medicine so successful.
Jordan, there is more that we do not know about the brain than we do. That's fair, right?
I would agree, yes.
So every time we perform a surgery on the brain, isn't there at least a small chance that you'll affect personality?
Depending on the location in the brain you're working, that is, you know, certainly a concern that we take into account. And, you know, there's a very interesting literature in the neuroethics world about this. You even have, you know, interventions such as deep brain stimulation that, you know, may have some cognitive side effects where, you know, that's taken into account, that there may be some personality changes when you're dealing with brain damage, such as from an injury or trauma.
Sorry, I just want to stop for just one second in case our listeners were left behind. Deep brain stimulation is where you implant a medical device inside the brain, which stimulates the brain. It sends out electrical impulses to specific parts of the body. Okay, go ahead.
That's correct. And, you know, but even when you're dealing with patients who've not had surgery but had a brain injury to the frontal lobes, for instance, which are part of the brain that controls some aspects of our personality, you can see these identity or personality changes. But, I think you said something very important, Celeste, which is that there's more that we don't know than we know. And I think when it comes to the proposals around so-called head transplantation, That's really a factor that comes into play. It's not merely a matter of sort of suturing a head onto a cadaver, as some in the popular media may have made it seem. I mean, this is really a adventure in medical science fiction. When you're talking about connecting the spinal cord that has been cut to another spinal cord, and then making that connected spinal cord functional, that is something that has never been done. And I would say to Dr. Canavero and his colleagues, if you can do that, I know millions or know of millions of spinal cord injury patients who would love to have you help them restore the ability to walk before
with
you
their own spinal cord. Yeah. Right.
Even yes. Yeah. I mean, that alone, I mean, that innovation alone, if they are correct, would be mind-boggling. And so I'm very keen to see the evidence. As always, I keep an open mind. But, you know, they're proposing something here that would be very outside the mainstream and really shocking if it were to be successful.
Is it a different ethical conversation, Paul, when you're doing any kind of procedure that affects personality?
Sure. And here we don't even know what that means. So as Jordan says, certainly personality has its main locus in the brain. But our second largest nervous system is in the gut, the enteric nervous system. There are more neurotransmitters in your gut than there are in your brain. We do not know what the contribution of that...
Is that what we mean by gut instinct?
It is exactly what we mean. We get feedback from our gut, and our gut sends enormous numbers of signals up to our head. We have no idea what that means, what its implications are for who I am and my personality and what Paul-ness is. And so if you took another head and put it on my body, we don't know what the contribution of my body's signals going up to that brain would mean for the personality of that combined individual. We just have no idea because there's no real way to test that.
Although it didn't work out so great for Frankenstein. So if we are to learn from fiction, then maybe we should take a deep breath here. Paul Wolpe is the director of Center for Ethics at Emory University, and Jordan Amadio is chief resident in neurosurgery at Emory. Jordan and Paul, thank you both so very much.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you, Celeste.
Two U.S. congressmen resigned last week, one Democrat, one Republican. They are the latest men to face consequences for alleged sexual misconduct. Sarah Cook is a Georgia State University psychology professor. She says the way we describe the Me Too movement is important, and she offers this commentary.
My name is Sarah Cook. I'm a professor of psychology at Georgia State University. I've studied violence against women for more than 20 years. And I've watched public outrage over harassment and sexual assault wax and wane. Now my question is, could this time be different? The sheer number of reports is new. It's also new to see organizations like NPR or the Academy of Motion Picture Artists hold leadership accountable for failure to intervene. But other aspects of this cultural moment are all too familiar. Already, I've heard the terms Weinsteining, or the Weinstein effect. This language removes women from their stories, and it creates a narrow focus on a singular perpetrator. These cutesy terms also diminish the agony of deciding whether to make a formal complaint. Those who have been victimized say they fear reprisal. They fear no one will believe them, and they also feel shame, guilt, and embarrassment. Another way of undermining women is to downgrade their reports from the categories of harassment, sexual assault, and rape, and instead label them abuse, minor bad behavior, or even innocent miscommunication, diminishing and undermining the process of women reporting experiences of sexual harassment, rape, and other forms of assault by calling it Weinsteining allows predators to hold on to power. Describing women's real experiences that match the horror they faced is a first step toward dismantling that power and the structures that support it. If more women come forward and name their experiences, others will remember that bad manners, Assault and harassment are not synonymous.
That was Sarah Cook, professor of psychology at Georgia State University. You can find her research and writing at our website, gpbnews.org. Just ahead, what it's like to grow up in rural Georgia through the eyes of a redneck squid. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tuesday, we talk about the best Southern albums of 2017, and we want to hear from you. What album do you think belongs on that list? You can call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for that conversation. Squidbillies is Atlanta-based Adult Swim's third longest-running animated series. It's based on the show creators' experiences right here in Georgia, and it features a cast of anthropomorphic redneck squids. The 11th season of Squidbillies comes to a close this Sunday on Adult Swim. Co-creators Dave Willis and Jim Fortier recently joined me to talk about the 11th season.
Hello.
How are you?
Thanks for having us.
So, Dave, you were actually born in Texas and raised in Conyers, right?
Yes. The fact that I was born in Texas really has nothing to do with it.
Because you were not conscious.
No.
When
I was not conscious when that happened.
But Conyers isn't, you wouldn't call that a redneck town, right?
Yeah, I would.
You would?
Jim and I were both raised in Conyers, though Jim spent more time in Illinois, I guess, early.
Right. I was born in Boston, actually, and we moved around a little bit. But I ended up in Georgia, in Conyers, in 81.
Because, it occurs to me, I wonder how much of this... The town in Squidbillies is supposed to be in Blue Ridge up in the North Georgia Mountains, mm-hmm. right? So how much of that is actually based on things you observed in Conyers, taken to the extreme and the stereotypical?
Well, we haven't. I haven't been to Conyers for any longer than a half a day in 20 years now. But when we moved there in the early 80s, it was still a developing place. It was still sort of a much more of a country vibe and not very built up. It was one main road going through town and a two-screen cinema, at the time. Very, very small place, very, friendly, but really country. And I think my perspective was even more vivid coming from the Midwest and coming in there at 11 years old and kind of having
culture shock.
Culture shock, work the accent out, understand what people are saying, different personalities, different values. And it left a big impression on me. I think that we kind of, we enhance it, exaggerate it,
of course,
for the show. But that's, I think, where I'm drawing from.
If you have never, if some of our listeners have never seen Squidbillies, it's this family of squids, and they're endangered. They're part of the Appalachian mud squids, right?
Yep.
So that's the nominal reason why they get away with just untold amount of property destruction and death.
Sounds good. Keep going. I'd watch this.
Why squids?
The word sounded funny, Squidbillies. I think our boss came in with the word one day and was like, Squidbillies. Like, yeah, I'd watch that show. And then he was like, why don't you guys make it? So.
Wait, so he came in with the word Squidbillies and the whole show came from that?
Yeah, it's a funny word, Squidbillies.
It is.
So we just funneled a lot of our experience, not just the Conyers experience, but Atlanta, blue city and a red state. The fact that we're a whole network that's down here, which is not in New York or L.A., is it's, you know, we just funnel what we hear in our day-to-day lives, into the show.
So when you are creating the show, do you think of it as a sort of a parody of the South or a parody of people's stereotypes of what they think the South is?
I think it can be a little bit of both, honestly. And this can be a dangerous thing to say, but I always feel like our main character is a little bit like a Archie Bunker type. You know, he says and does all the wrong things. With any luck, he gets a version of his comeuppance. Sometimes it's an angle we're taking for a reason. Sometimes it's just because it's funny, or it's because there have been people who've had such and such an opinion, and we want to parody it. Other times, we might be making a little bit of fun of some of the people we knew growing up, or some of the things we saw people do, or some of the lack of a governor for behavior that we've met in certain people. So I think it can be a little bit of both.
So let's hear a clip. In this family, there's an alcoholic dad named Early, and you might have seen his picture. He often has that hat with a Confederate flag on it in memes that says heritage, not hate. And then there's the teen son named Rusty, and there's the mom who's called the granny, and then there's the little sister named Lil. So here's a little clip of the father, and he's talking to his son, Rusty.
What did I tell you about perseverance, young man?
That if at first you don't succeed, it wasn't meant to be. It's a waste of time, because the union's just going to take your money anyway. And you were an unwanted pregnancy, and you ruined my dirt biking career. And get out of my sight. You disgust me. You talk about that one, Daddy?
So, I mean, at what point do you guys have discussions, or do you ever, on political correctness and whether or not you have to care about it?
Politically, I don't think we're either one of us is politically correct in the sense of the term, but we're also, without getting too much into politics, I think we're both probably veering a little more left of center than right in our views. But I just think the caricature of anyone who votes Democrat is that it's politically correct. I'm like, what, because you read a book? Because you read a newspaper? Jim said he hadn't been in Conyers in 20 years, and my parents are still there, but, you know, and I'm still on Facebook with people, and I got an argument the other day where I was like, I had to go, all right, let's get this straight. So you think rap music and video games caused that guy to shoot up Las Vegas? Like, those are the arguments you have, and then you're like, then you look up the person, and they just got a bunch of pictures of snakes for their whole profile, and like, is it another snake I found? And you're like, why am I even doing this?
Yeah, I would recommend not arguing on Facebook. You guys do get into politics, though. Here is the dad Early again, and he's talking about immigrant workers.
Mexico has to go. You hire and work, say Mexico. Red, white, and blue will work for you. Except for the job that we won't do. Hanging sheetrock, we won't do. Painting houses, we won't do. Anything septic, we won't do. Drive for NASCAR, sure we'll do.
Okay. So, I mean, of all the anime, of all the animated shows that come and go, because there's a lot, right? What do you think keeps this one on the air and popular? What is the staying power?
I think that our bosses feel guilty if they put us out on the street because we've been there
a really long time.
They saw us have kids and families, and they feel responsible. I don't feel like I can answer that question. I mean, I think we pull in just as good an audience as almost anything else on the network. So the people who enjoy the show, who we are super appreciative of, I know it's a cop-out, but it's sort of a question for them. I mean, we're making a show that we sit across, you know, the old cliche, we sit across the room and talk about things that make us laugh and what we insane stuff we'd want to see animated with these characters, and we make that show. And we're not – they don't lord over us too carefully about what we do. And I think we just make that show. We put it out there, and maybe the fact that it's not being picked and poked by 100 different people before it hits the screen and it's just this dumb, silly, animated redneck squid show just – gives it a charm that keeps it on the air.
They were incredibly topical, too. You know, something will happen in the news, and then 17 months later, we can attack it.
Not quite as fast as South Park.
No, not quite.
Although we were very prescient a few times, though. That clip you just played about the wall. Early was going to build a wall, And he ended up just building a wall around his own property.
Right.
And he had the Mexican people come build the wall for him before he expelled them. And then they realized they were imprisoning themselves. And this was years ago.
It's just like there's a Donald Trump tweet for every occasion. There's a Squidbillies clip for every occasion.
Right. Well, here's another one. This is the sheriff. And the sheriff is kind of the one that sort of protects them in the way. It's the opposite of the Dukes of Hazzard. He's the one that sort of lets them get away with everything. He's confronting the little sister, Lil, about her behavior.
Hey, Lil. Excuse me. Did you know that moonshine is illegal in this county here?
Oh, that's just my meth lab.
Huh.
Okay, so do you think, I mean, when you look at some of the shows that have some of the sort of edgiest material on them, they're often animated shows. Is it because there's not a real person saying some of these things that people tolerate it more?
It's hard to make a live action meth addict funny. But animated somehow maybe takes a layer off of it or adds a layer. Maybe it adds a layer. I don't know.
Of distance.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of the same thing. Now, used to voice Barry on Archer. But that's another show that sort of gets away with a lot of things that you probably couldn't do in live action.
Right. But you can do anything in animation. I mean, do totally anything, which that's great. It's really hard to shoot whatever you come up with, but animation, you can do anything.
What attracts you to the job of voicing something for animated as opposed to being a live actor in an actual TV or movie?
Well, I would do the other thing too, but no one's hiring for that. I mean, this is what we do, you know, we make cartoons and then invariably we find ourselves saying the lines in the way we want to hear them. And we try to cast parts. I think Jim had said earlier that we were trying to talk to. Unfortunately, we were trying to talk to Tom Petty about playing something for us, like the week before he passed. And we're looking for unique voices, specifically for Squidbillies, unique Southern voices, and they're hard to find. They're hard to find that humor and that acting ability. And so when we find somebody, you know, they're like gold. I mean, somebody like Unknown Henson who plays Early or, Bobby Ellerbe who plays the sheriff is just a Southern guy through and through. And he's also a funny guy. He's an actor. Daniel McDivitt who plays Rusty. He was a high school buddy of ours who's a pilot for Delta who just happens to be a super funny guy who gets our sense of humor.
He chose a respectable career.
Yeah, right.
But he can still work with us sometimes.
And you guys have a number of musical guests. I'll play a little bit. We have a little clip of a tape of a guest musician covering the main theme song. My dreams are dead and buried.
Are you okay?
Sometimes I wish the sun would just explode.
My dreams are all dead and buried. Sometimes I wish the sun would just explode.
My dreams are all dead and buried. Sometimes I wish the sun would just explode.
So that was the B-52s, Father John Misty, and then Nico Case. And you've had the Drive-By Truckers on. You've had a lot of different people. What makes somebody the right musical act for Squidbillies?
I think it's whoever responds. I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's just sort of fantasy. Everybody who you've ever listened to will reach out to, you know. There's no real rhyme or reason to it other than just hearing somebody and going, man, it would be so great to have them do this. And this year we have Bob Mould, we have Stephen Malkmus, Camper Van Beethoven, John Prine.
Steve Earle.
I'm blanking. Steve Earle.
Al Yankovic.
Steve Earle did an original song for us. Jason Isbell is sort of a regular character on the show now. This is sort of our way to reach out and be just a tiny part of this musician's life that we love. It's great. We have 10 opportunities every season, so it's awesome.
What makes Atlanta a particularly good place for animation? I mean, is it just that Adult Swim is here, but there's all kinds of other projects thriving?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to have seen it all come here, because we grew up here and we went to school in the South, and I don't know of any other animation that was going on in town at that time. I guess the Georgia Film Commission started to try to bring people in. You know, they're shooting all these films and things. The Archer guys were at Cartoon Network doing C-Lab.
Yeah.
Dave and Matt Malero were doing Aqua Teen eventually. Chris Kelly working on a show he had, Stroker and Hoop. A guy, Michael O'Lean, across the street working on Harvey Birdman. Suddenly all these, we were just making these shows because they wanted these shows to go on at night on Adult Swim. And by way of doing that, they just kind of built it. And why is it good here? I don't know. We watched the community sort of grow out of nothing. We just kind of found all these folks one way or another and really built a relationship with them and created an industry. You know, we created it. You, me, and Dave. No, just kidding. but you know, it just kind of it sprung up. I don't know what makes Atlanta better or than some other place. For me, it's better because I never had to move. And we've been at it for 20-plus years, you know, in town. And you can do all the same type of work here. You can write a script here. You can find a production company that's competent, does a great job. And we do that.
So, I mean, I know a lot of people are excited for the new season. But is there no end to the number of things that you can write about on Squidbillies? I mean, I know that must be the number one question that Simpsons writers get, right? Is how do you keep coming up with stories? And I wonder if you get that question all the time, too.
The question I see most often is, why is this show still on the air?
No, come on.
On Twitter. Who is paying attention? I don't know. I don't hear that question too much. I mean, that's a question we ask each other just about what we just want to make sure we're not redoing something we did, you know, 8 seasons ago now. Because believe it or not, two or three people writing 100 plus shows of an 11 minute show, you can find yourself stumbling into a season 2 storyline and having to go, wait a minute, we did that. But it doesn't mean we're out of idea. I mean, there's always new stuff happening. There's always stuff you remember. There's always some angle and something we can take. And if we're doing it well, it's not just about something that's happening. That's just an element of it. And you want to see what these characters are going to do and how they react. And I don't think we're exhausted on what we can do with these guys yet at all.
Who's the best of them, of the family? Who's the best person? Squid?
Rusty used to be like a sort of a dirt biking, you know, always a cast on one arm, wild man in the mold of his father.
He's the closest we're going to get in that family to breaking the cycle. I mean, you heard the clip of Early and what he's instilled in him about if it doesn't work the first time, just give up. And and then the damage he laid on him about you were an unwanted pregnancy that ruined my... I mean, that's what Rusty's dealing with. And at first, he just wanted his father's approval, I think, but as time's gone on, he maybe takes a step back and just goes, wait a second, maybe everything I'm hearing from this guy isn't legit.
As time has evolved, he's evolved into the voice of reason, the one that actually might have the closest take to how we might feel about a situation, but he's not above screwing up.
That was Dave Willis. You also heard from Jim Fortier. They are co-creators of Adult Swim's animated show, Squidbillies. The show's season finale for the 11th season premieres on Adult Swim this Sunday at midnight. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. We talked earlier about the questions that are generated by the possibility of a head transplant. Do you think that is unethical? Does it go too far? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.